After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Everyone, I have the pleasure of sitting today with Alistair McIntosh. Alistair, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Raghu. And my wife and I are a great fan of your show, so it's wonderful to be with you.
Thank you. So Alistair has a wonderful book that he did a few years ago that really struck my fancy. It's called Spiritual Activism. And we're going to talk about that book today. And Alistair, I love this. It has been described by BBC TV as one of the world's leading environmental campaigners. I like that word, campaigner. A pioneer of modern land reform in Scotland, he helped bring the Isle of Eigg into community ownership. And so you've been working with a lot of different land projects and community projects, and you teach. Tell us a little about, just a little bit. How did you arrive at all of this as a young man?
Well, I grew up in the Isle of Lewis in the Outer Hebrides of Scotland, Raghu. And it wasn't until I was in my 20s when I went with voluntary service overseas, which is like your Peace Corps, to Papua New Guinea and spent in total 4 years there, that I encountered people who were very closely connected with the land. And they asked me how much land I had, and I said, well, we don't have any because it's all owned by big landowners who colonized it. And they said, well, we thought all you white people were rich. How can you be rich if you've got no land? And of course, it meant rich in a sense of spiritually rich, of depth of connection with place and so on. So that got me thinking. And when I got back to Scotland after the second time in Papua New Guinea in 1986, I started working for something called the Iona Community, which is about spiritual regeneration based around the island of Iona. And the former youth worker of that, Tom Forsyth, was sent to see me, by which time I was teaching human ecology in Edinburgh University. And he said, how about we form a charitable trust, a land trust that doesn't have any money, but we take on the challenge to landed power, because the island of Eigg is up for sale. It's been forced onto the market by a court order. And by creating a situation where the natives are restless, we can spoil the market, so to speak. So to cut the long story short, in 1997, 22 years ago, the island of Eigg came into community ownership. We now have some 400 or so land trusts in Scotland with land reform legislation, and nearly 3% of Scotland's land is in community land trusts.
Wow, that's amazing, especially when you think of your history and your history with England hundreds and hundreds of years ago, which was very, very, shall we say, challenging for people who are from Scotland, no?
Indeed so. And, you know, my own mother is English, my father's Scottish. This is much deeper than, you know, English or Scottish things. This is about the way in which, in general, our minds and not just our lands have become colonized. And in order to decolonize the land, we've got to work on decolonizing the mind. And that's why for me and my close colleagues in this, the movement has always been one of liberation theology, of understanding what it is to be a human being in a way that leads to liberation at multiple levels. Liberation was the land in that political sense and so on, but also liberation psychologically and spiritually.
Mm. Which brings us to the book and brings us to some of the things that you expound upon in the book. There's one, I mean, now everybody out there, Alistair came to me because of his familiarity with Ram Dass, and all of you know of our relationship with Ram Dass, and this is the Be Here Now network. And as you well know, Ram Dass from the very beginning has done a lot of activism, and he's been a part of many different organizations that activism was at the center of what they were doing. And his thing has always been, if you're going to go out there and change the world, change your insides at the same time. It's not like you got to get to be an enlightened being before you can do anything, but certainly if you go out there and you are angry and you are polarizing, it's going to be a very a difficult task to change anything. And so this, when I saw your book, Alistair, I was like, wow, okay, this is so in alignment with everything that we understand. And I love this thing right at the beginning of the book. You get straight, okay, what is spirituality? This is a good question. It's something I've never thought of, you know, myself. And the presence, here it is, your interpretation, the presence of God, Goddess, Allah, Christ, Brahman, whoever, in our lives. The presence in our lives. The inner aspect of reality and that which gives life, and specifically life as love made manifest. That is that's a beautiful translation, really, of what spirituality is. And so just tell me how this really does inform. I mean, and you throughout the book talk about the different ways in which we can bring, I call it, divine presence into our lives, bring, you know, inner knowledge, you call it, and I call it, you know, self-inquiry, the Ramana Maharshi, I think you know who Ramana Maharshi is. So the self-inquiry thing, how important that is. And then what Ram Dass talks about now, which is moving into a perspective in the center of your chest, which is from loving awareness. So really combining awareness and love.
Yeah.
So yeah, just talk about how that has really informed your work, this realization of bringing in the spiritual nature that is our true heritage.
I think it's what the veteran Quaker mediator, and I am a Quaker by convincement, Adam Curl, calls... He speaks of being convicted in the heart. You get pulled deeply into that space where you have to, as he puts it, unclench the fist around the frozen heart. So I think that is the starting point. And then you move on to, like, Gandhi. And my co-author in this book, because I'm not the sole author, a younger climate change activist, Matt Carmichael from England, he and I make use of a quotation from Mahatma Gandhi, where Gandhi says, he's talking about satyagraha, truth force, or God force, soul force. And Gandhi is saying that the opposite of satya is asatya, without truth, without God. But that the word satya also means reality. So you can either be in reality or you can be out of reality. And for me, the essence of spiritual activism is grounding ourselves in the deep reality, which is the cutting edge of the wave of life itself. It is that of Buddha nature in us. It is where the Atman is the Brahman. It is a case of I live, yet not I, but Christ lives within me, as St. Paul on one of his good days put it.
And one of his good days. You also quote somebody else, Gustavo Gutierrez.
Gustavo Gutierrez.
Is the Peruvian father of this liberation theology. I've never heard of this. Liberation theology itself can measure up to the task of liberating humankind, perhaps like Mahayana. I love how you tie all this stuff together. It's just so much us. I mean, how we've the mystic tradition.
It's a tangled ball of string. You pull in one thread and they're connected to all the others.
Yeah. And like Mahayana Buddhism with its Tibetan Book of Great Liberation, Gutierrez sees that true religion is the practice of setting life free. And I love his formula, to liberate equals to give life.
To liberate. That's Gustavo Gutierrez, the father of liberation theology. And I define liberation theology as theology that liberates theology to do the task of liberation. Mm. Because so much of the theology that we inherit, whether we're Christian, Muslim, Jews, Buddhists, or whatever, so much of it actually locks us into things. You know, Ram Dass is always saying, the method is great, but the method becomes a trap. So you've got to recognize when the method's becoming a trap and spring the trap. That's what liberation theology does. And you see, when Jesus says, I come to give my life a ransom for many or a ransom for all, as St. Paul has it, the fundamentalists interpret that in a military sense of a military ransom, a kind of deal with the devil or a deal with God, whichever way you want to look at it. But if you actually look at the Greek word that Jesus uses is lutron or lytron, from which we get the English word loosen, because it means to liberate. A ransom is that which liberates. I come to give my life to liberate all. How? By the power of nonviolence, by ahimsa, by that satyagraha that the cross, if we want to look at the Christian representation of this, the cross represents, because the cross absorbs the violence of the world by its nonviolence. And so to me, these are deep insights. These are pathways into how we do the work of love in the world. Ram Dass, you know, the reason I love Ram Dass's stuff so much is he's coming out of that deep Jewish tradition, further informed by his Hinduism. And he says, you know, he said it at one point, he says, and I often quote him on this, if in doubt what to do with your life, feed the hungry. And whenever I get young potential activists come to me, which I do all the time, saying, how can we become an activist? I say, if in doubt what to do, literally or metaphorically, go out and feed the hungry, and then you will find yourself fed also.
So true. I mean, we went all the way over to India. We went back to India with when Ram Dass went back the second time after we had heard his whole experience over there, and we went back, and many of us were, okay, you know, you found a Hindu guru, and all right, how are we going to get in line? I mean, we were in our 20, so we were a little bit naive, to say the very least. But you know, how are we going to raise the kundalini and you know, how are we going to get enlightened, Maharaj? Come on. Yeah. And, you know, he'd say, feed people. And Ram Dass would just, in this movie, we have a new movie called Becoming Nobody with Ram Dass, and, you know, which covers the arc of his teachings in life, which is quite beautiful, which we hope you'll see one day. But in it, he said, yeah, that kind of seemed real hokey to me. I was looking for the, you know, meditate for 10 years in a cave and then you'll get enlightened. And he's telling me to feed people, serve people. We were all looking for the big statement from Maharaji to do some real practice, you know, to spend a long time in retreat in a cave. Or stand on our head, fitting bullets, or whatever the hell we were thinking about. And the simplicity of serve people, well, love, serve, remember, which is the name of the foundation that we have that takes care of all of these activities from all of us, and Ram Dass, of course, being the main one. And it seems too simple, right? But it is so real. And you telling people, yes, yeah, start out, feed somebody, either literally or metaphorically, meaning just be with somebody and completely give them your total attention. That's feeding people. And
That's it.
Yeah, that's it.
And I mean, Ram Dass does that so well. And, you know, you folk around him, supporting him, even in his advanced old age now. What gives me respect for Ram Dass is that he's come out of a privileged family background. He could so easily have just wallowed in that and soaked up all the guru thing and so on. But no, you know, he goes out and he helps blind people. He sits with people who are dying and all the rest of it. That gives me real respect for him. He has taken the blessings that life has given them and he's used them to spread enlightenment. And I, for one, are very, you know, he's one of my many teachers indirectly, but I'm so grateful for the insights and also, Raghu, to yourself for making available all these podcasts. Viren, my wife and I, we avidly devour each Ram Dass podcast that comes out. And just so grateful for that, because these are good teachings and they are about feeding one another. And, you know, so often in today's world, people, they do the yoga, or they may do the yoga, but they forget the karma. So you don't get the full karma yoga. You don't get the union with God that comes about through the work of service. And that's why Matt Carmichael and I subtitled the spiritual activism book, Leadership of Service.
Now, there's somebody I never heard of that's in your book that really fascinated me, Alistair. And that's Basava. Basava, I don't even know if I'm pronouncing it right. Basava. And yeah, tell his story. Can you do it?
Well, I'm going to have to pass on that because I would say this is a joint author book and that section was written by Matt. So, you know, he's not here. So I really have to pass on that one because I couldn't authoritatively tell you except that he was one of these early Hindu teachers or quasi-Hindu teachers who pointed the way down the activist path.
This is like, well, all right, I've got the page up here. I'm gonna
you tell us what spoke to you in that page.
Okay, great. So he lived 850 years ago and he was a highly educated Indian mystic and was appointed as finance minister by King Bidala of the Kalachuri dynasty. And he succeeded in increasing the kingdom's prosperity while promoting equality and human dignity. I mean, 850 years ago, okay? As one of his sayings went, the cow does not give milk to whoever sits on its back, but it gives milk to whoever squats at its feet. Okay, yeah. That did me right away, Alistair. I mean, what a great thing.
Beautiful.
And Times of India in 1918 claimed he implemented a comprehensive program of social reform with the elevation and independence of womanhood as its guiding point. That's also extraordinary considering our human history and how and what's going on right now in that area.
Sure.
It's pretty amazing. Sure. And Gandhi said, it's not been possible for me to practice all the precepts of Basava. One does not find even shades of casteism in him. Wow.
There we go.
That's all. The casteism being the rigid social class system of institutional Hinduism. And he was radical in his religious beliefs, suggesting a personal mysticism that took him beyond the bounds of tradition. And so many mystics have done, he undermined religious authority and taught that pilgrimage and temple worship were not necessary. This is like Kabir, who is Maharaji used to, he didn't quote a lot of people, but Kabir was one of them. And because everyone was equal in God's eyes. And of course, he got into trouble with the local priest, as they all do, you know, because that kind of usurping takes money out of their hands, right? When the people go for
that,
the truth.
That was the problem with Jesus. You know, he took money out of the temple's hands because he overturned their tables and discredited their corrupt system, their corrupt sacrificial system. So this is always the problem with the two prophets, that they undermine the religious authorities and undo conventional religion by which people are controlled and kept, at least in part, enslaved.
So
as you're saying with your cow, you know, Pasiphae and the cow, you know, the cow doesn't give milk to who rides on its back. It gives milk to who sits at its feet. And it's a bit like that story that Carl Jung has, that a young rabbi said to an old rabbi, you know, why was it that in the past the sages saw God, whereas now nobody sees God any longer? And the old rabbi says, because these days nobody is prepared to stoop low enough.
Mm. Beautiful. I didn't know that. That's great. Yeah. Oh, that's
and that's where, you know, engagement with poverty, engagement with the poor, engagement where there is suffering, where the environment is broken, where people are broken. That's why these things are the path to God. These things are the path of karma yoga. These things are the object of our bhakti, of our devotion.
Mm. So I want to go backwards a little bit. I still want to get from you just the transformational points in your early life that opened you to certainly to spirituality, or was it activism or the idea that you felt you needed to do something in this world to make it a better place? Which came first, or did they both happen at the same time, and what were the triggers?
Yeah, well, you know, I grew up in a very conventional Protestant Presbyterian environment on the Isle of Lewis. And in many ways, that was very deep, and it was a real living community. So my understanding of community as membership one of another is basically coming from the island. But the island theology was, you know, very much at that time a hellfire type of theology. It was quite a hardline Calvinist theology. And when I got to university, when I was 17 years old, I quickly, you know, this was at the time of transcendental meditation and the whole, you know, the 60s counterculture revolution. It took a few years to reach up with us in the north of Scotland. So I kind of hit that at the epicenter when I went to university in 1973. And that was what then opened me to things like reading the Bhagavad Gita. And to the idea that there could be such a thing as mystical experience or spiritual experience, and also to the reality that there is desperate poverty, desperate suffering in the world. The Buddha's recognition that suffering exists is the fundamental fact. And so I became absolutely obsessed with these things. I failed my mainstream exams in mainly science subjects that I was studying because I was so busy reading all these spiritual texts. I managed to scrape through university in the end. But I became convinced, you know, I wanted to go to it like you guys were doing. I wanted to go to India and find my guru, which is why I applied to do voluntary service overseas. Well, they didn't send me to India. Instead, they sent me to Papua New Guinea, which rather disappointed me at first. And what's more, Raghu, can you imagine being sent from the highly Presbyterian Isle of Lewis to a Catholic, a Roman Catholic mission station in the outback of Papua New Guinea? But, it was run by a retired Australian archbishop, a saintly man called Virgil Kupas, and four Mother Teresa missionaries of charity nuns, three of them from India. And so there I was, living amongst these folk, immersed in their Christian spirituality, reading my Bhagavad Gita and Upanishads and Tao Te Ching and all the rest of it, and experiencing daily the humility and the example and the sheer goodness of these people and their work with hard-pressed people in Papua New Guinea. So that really touched me, and that, helped by the metaphysical insights of Hinduism, brought me back into reappreciating the Christian scriptures and indeed reappreciating the traditions in which I had been raised, albeit with a critical eye. That also set me on the path of deciding that I had to devote my life to working in the non-profit sector. So to that end, I went back to university, to Edinburgh University, and did an MBA, a Master's in Business Administration, in 1980 because I wanted to have the skills necessary for management, as George MacLeod, who founded the Iona community in Scotland at Iona Abbey, once said, "God is never served by inefficiency," which is one of the reasons why Matt Carmichael and I wrote Spiritual Activism, because we wanted to emphasize the importance of being effective in the activism that we do. And then that led me on into the land reform that I've described, and the work that I do now with urban poverty here in Glasgow, and also work with non-violence. I work a lot with the military, giving lectures on non-violence and why non-violence is important, an important thing for them to understand in the world. So I speak at military staff colleges and that. That's a kind of range of work that I'm involved with.
That's pretty amazing. Non-violence to the army. I love that. but it seems like your destiny, going to Papua New Guinea, and the destiny of that, where it really brought together your interest in both of these areas, which really become one, because there's no way you can look around the world without a sense of feeling of what can I do. I mean, it's very difficult, and compassion is so innate in us. And so that's why I love what you're doing here, Alistair, that, you know, how you're bringing these two things together. Because many people think, you know, okay, yeah, you want to get spiritual and that's selfish. You're just going to do something for yourself and you're not doing anything for anybody else. And in reality, these two things, you know, fit as a glove with each other. And they really are one.
They come together. They come together so closely. And can I tell you a short story, Raghu?
Please.
That when I was coming back from Papua New Guinea on the first occasion, so this would be in 1980, March 1980, I was traveling back overland because I wanted to do that, you know, that kind of old hippie India trip that you folk had done, except didn't have the money to go to any very much, so the trip was fairly limited. But I made it to Darjeeling, and one morning there was a knock on the door of the little place I was staying in. And there was a peddler with all his tourist trinkets, and he had them spread out and was wanting to sell them. So I kind of sat down with him because he had sapphire blue eyes, and there was a quality to this man. You know how you can just sense a spiritual quality about people. So I sat down with him, and he was from Sikkim, which was just over the border. And he took a prayer wheel and started rotating it around. Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum. Now, you know, I'd read various commentaries on what those words mean. But it's always interesting to do as what we in Scotland refer to as asking a daft laddie question, the kind of question that a silly little boy would ask. So, acting as if I didn't have any knowledge of it, I just said to him, "What does Om Mani Padme Hum mean?" And you know what he said? He didn't talk about the jewel or the heart of the lotus or anything like that. He just said, "It means God come to my heart. God come to my heart. Om Mani Padme Hum. God come to my heart." And then, you know, old Jesus, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God." And so these are the kind of things that the teaching was wove together, and how the hunger for God, the pursuit of the divine, God, Goddess, Allah, Brahman, I don't care what you want to call it, Buddha, Nietzsche, whatever, Christ, I think is a particularly beautiful manifestation, but that's just my background. And the way that that binds in with feeding the hungry, was being there for one another, was looking out for one another as we walk along the street, keeping our eyes open, reading the street, watching for things, watching for opportunities where you can make a connection of the heart with other human beings.
Beautiful, beautiful. Well said, Alistair. Love that.
now there's sometimes easier said than done, but
right. All of it is easier said than done. All of it, all of it. Broadening your heart space and not being afraid to go out and just do something for somebody else and forget about yourself. That's what this whole Becoming Nobody film, by the way, we just did with featuring Ram Dass. And it's about that. I say to people, like, we just had an opening actually here. I'm in Maui. And the film opened at the Maui Film Festival just the other night. And I said, okay, what is Becoming Nobody? What does that mean? Well, here's it in most simple terms. When I first met Ram Dass, and by the way, everybody out there listening, I know you've heard this before, but Alistair hasn't. So be patient. When I first met Maharaji, Ram Dass,
same difference.
It was in Montreal, and I was asked to announce that he was giving a lecture at McGill University in Montreal, and I didn't know who he was. I said, "Well, send me a tape over." I loved Leary and Albert, which I found out that's who Ram Dass was. And I listened to the lecture, and I was completely, "Oh my God, this is everything I've been waiting to hear." But I got to find him, and they gave me an address, and I went out there and I knocked on the door, and he opened the door, and just complete presence in the moment. There was no Richard Albert. There was just attention on me. Kindness, attention, and just totally being here now with me. And Be Here Now wasn't even out there. It wasn't out at that point. So I didn't have those terms. All I knew is that I felt taken care of and cared for in that moment. Mm. And that was him completely. He was nobody. In other words, his mini-me, his Richard Alpertness, was defaced in that moment. He was able to let go of that and be here for me. So that was my first experience of somebody, complete stranger, doing something like that. And that's that's what Becoming Nobody. And of course, we all have to go a million miles, maybe we're thinking, to get to that point. But and I think you're doing this with the work that you're doing. It's every moment that you give yourself an opportunity to open up enough and where you don't have any defense mechanisms in the moment. You just work to the moment where there's no defense mechanisms protecting yourselves from what? I mean, ourselves. I mean, we do protect ourselves on a moment-to-moment basis about so many different aspects of that fear comes in with another person. Just go meet a stranger and you can watch your defense pop up, just pop up. The beauty. That's our every moment. We have an opportunity to come back to that place where we feel connected, and it's okay to let down our defenses. Becoming Nobody.
People say to me, how do you do the activism? And I say, well, you go and take up a brush and sweep the floor. And they say, no, I want to do the kind of activism you do, like, the community buyout of egg, or saving the mountain that was going to be turned into a major quarry or something like that. I say, yeah, that's how you do it. You go in and you say what most needs to be done. You pick up the brush and sweep the floor. You do the photocopying. And some of them get it. And others, like the rich young man that Jesus talked about, he walked away sadly because he was very rich. He wasn't prepared to let go of it. And if we walk through the world, if we walk to the bus, if we walk through a railway station or an airport or whatever it might be, if we walk through the world just watching out, reading the street, looking for things like maybe somebody struggling upstairs with their bags or somebody's dropped something or something like that, you will find no end of little opportunities to make these connections. And some of them just become so deeply magic. It happened, every time I go out, I come back and tell my wife another story of what's just happened. Because if you're receptive to it, it comes to you and it blows your own mind, Raghu. It blows your own mind, it's kind of like you're just tripping on the experience because such beauty unfolds. And especially so when you're, we live in a in a nice house in a hard-pressed community here in Govan in Glasgow, but especially amongst communities of relatively poor people who aren't kind of hiding themselves behind all of that wealth and performance and what have you. You get such deep naturalness and real love expressed in community.
Mm. Yeah, really. Now, one thing you go into that's very important, I think, in one of your chapters, you say for some people, the question of whether spirituality is quote unquote for real does not require evidence. It seems self-evident, but for many people, it is not. And this is one of the big hills that many people, you know, climb. Talk about that a little bit, Alistair. Around consciousness and the nature.
To me, it was a very important question, Raghu, because, you know, I grew up in a fairly heavy relatively fundamentalist religious context in which belief in God, Christ, and so on was a kind of given. Nobody would doubt those things. And yet I had all kinds of intellectual questions. And I felt that to be honest to life, I suppose I'm basically a scientist at heart in my way of thinking. I like to see evidence. So in my late teens, it became a burning question for me. Was there or was there not such a thing as spiritual reality? And one of the avenues I took for that was an intense study of parapsychology. If you go on my website, you'll see my earliest published papers are parapsychological papers, because it seemed to me that if there was evidence for transcending space and time, that turns the whole material world upside down. And I researched that very deeply, and I had in particular one very powerful experience with my mother when a dog died, and she knew from a distance what had happened. And so, you know, I thought, okay, well, there's a fair bit of evidence there, but somehow it wasn't satisfying deeply enough. And I started to realize that if you want to see God, you have to, you know, as that rabbi put it, you have to stoop low enough. You have to roll up your sleeves and be involved where the suffering is. Where is God? What side is God on? God is where the suffering is. What side of the war is God on? God is on the side of the war that is suffering. So as I immersed myself in that, I suppose that I would say that gradually the question not only started to dissolve, but I also started to have occasional intimations of transcendental experience. So in the book, I describe one of them of a potentially very violent encounter with somebody outside Iona Abbey one night, and my knees were literally shaking as I was holding this situation. And this man, who turned out to be an ex-army boxing champion, and he turned out later to have been dealing with his alcoholism by going into public venues and picking fights with people, was threatening to bury me 6 feet beneath the ground and swinging fists at me, just shaving past my nose to try and draw me into the fight. And I just, you know, there with my knees literally shaking like jelly, you know, I said to him, "You can strike me if you want, but I'm not going to strike you back." And as I said that, you know, there we were underneath a starlit Hebridean sky, the Milky Way stretched out above us. And I literally felt as if a huge hand scooped down from out of the sky and held me. And that whatever was going to happen, it was all right. Now, the situation dissolved. I mean, this had started off by the man shouting out erratically in the middle of a church service in Iona Abbey. It was a healing service. I had sat at the back because I was diffident about it. It was a bit, you know, I wasn't very comfortable with all of this Christian healing type stuff. So I sat right at the back. So I was there when this guy and his friend, a black American guy, came in and sat at the back, and he started singing very loudly and erratically in the first hymn. And then during the silence, he shouted out And if I might, on your program, Raghu, if I'm allowed to use this language because I'm quoting, he said, "Yeah, all a pile of fucking hypocrites. If Jesus fucking Christ could see you just now, he'd be ashamed of you." And, you know, the guy's poor friend was terribly embarrassed and eventually managed to get him to go out. And that was when something kicked in my mind, because I thought to myself, hey, ho-hum, this is meant to be a healer. How about putting it to the test? So I went outside, you see, and said, well, you're welcome to come back in, because it's a healing service if that's what you've come for. And that was when he said, well, who the fuck are you? And started challenging. Now, that situation resolved inwardly for me, in that I felt that incredible deep peace of being, literally, it felt like being held in the divine hand. And then my colleague, Helen Stephen, the justice and peace worker of the Iona community, came out and she took over. She took the man back into the Abbey afterwards, and he ended up playing beautiful Bach on the piano. And Raghu, do you know who that man was? That was R.D. Lang, Lang of the Divided Self during his crazy era. What a privilege, what a teaching, and what a practical experience of the divine. And do you know one other thing, Raghu? As he left that day, he told Helen, because the connection thereafter was Helen, not with me, he told Helen that he had experienced what he had experienced that night. He had decided he was going to join the church. Well, when his funeral service came, a Catholic priest surprised everybody, especially the relatives, by saying that unbeknown to anybody, Lang had joined the church before he died. I don't know if he did or not, but that's what, according to the obituary in one of our newspapers, happened. So, and, you know, these are the kind of experiences. These are the kind of experiences, Raghu. And when these things happen, you really get challenged, because you've got to say, well, either I believe my experience and all of the other stuff, all of the other documentation about people having spiritual experiences and the characteristics in common, or I disregard that. And in my case, I just decided to dive into the ocean and love swimming in it.
Let go, let God, as they say on the bumper sticker. But wait a minute. You mean to tell me this boxer, formerly in the armed forces, is the guy that threatened you and created this
thing? Ronnie Lang. Ronald Lang was R.D. Lang, who wrote The Divided Self.
Yeah, I know him.
I'm sure you do. Yeah, he was in the armed forces at one time, and he was a champion boxer.
Wow.
And in Clayton's, I've got behind me here, I can even reach it, Raghu, and show it to you. Here we are. This is John Clay's biography, R.D. Lang, A Divided Self. Because he was actually, you know, his insights came from his own troubles, not least.
Yeah.
And Clay talks about how at that time, this is what he was doing. He was going and picking fights because he enjoyed giving people a good hammering. And, you know, if I hadn't been armed by nonviolence, Raghu, as a shipyard worker said to me when I moved to Govan, and I inquired about, because, you know, it's an area that has a certain, or had a certain reputation coming out of poverty. He said to me, Alistair, what do you do when you're walking along the streets? You come into a difficult situation. He says, here's my advice to you. Never show fear, do show respect. Mm. Never show fear, do show respect. Right. And that was kind of like Gandhi talks about nonviolence being our shield. That kind of attitude was my shield. Had I known it was R.D. Lang, it would probably have been very different, because it would have shifted the ground. But I'm blessed that I didn't know who it was. So I had to, you know, face what I knew not what. And my goodness, when I read this biography, when I read this biography here, I thought to myself, goodness, I actually had a close shave. You know, I had a close shave that night. What a blessed outcome.
That's funny. You know, I don't know if you know it, but Lang and Ram Dass were friends. In fact,
Is that true?
Yeah, R.D. Lang. Ronnie came to India, and I actually met him with Ram Dass in up in the foothills of the Himalayas. He actually came. And Ram Dass was very interested in his work, and they were very aligned on many different things. And I can't wait to, Ram Dass is upstairs right now. I can't wait to go tell him. Oh, my God, wait till you hear this story of Ronnie Lang. Oh, it's unbelievable.
Well, you can read it to him, because I tell that story in the spiritual activism book. I think in the chapter on nonviolence.
Okay, great. I will do so. that's so great. I do want to get this in before we're getting close to the end, but... and it fits in with what we're talking about, where people acknowledge that the interior life and interior experience of quote unquote spirituality, which you've defined and we've defined before in the podcast, that mystical experience and brain function is part of one chapter that you're talking about. But in this, it's William James published a paper in Mind about the inhalation of nitrous oxide. Okay. As soon as I read this, he urged others to repeat his experiments in which the center and periphery of things seem to come together. The ego and its objects are one. So I had this I think I've mentioned this before, but it's a perfect timing for it. Last year, I was on my way to India, and I got an infected molar or something, and it had to be removed. And I didn't have much time, so they had to kind of just shove me into an appointment with a surgeon, dental surgeon. And I was a little nervous because I had to fly a few days later. So he said to me, don't worry about this. I just had the same thing done, and I just took some nitrous. It'll be fine. I go, can I have nitrous? I hadn't had nitrous in a long time. And he said, yeah, sure. So anyhow, we finally got into the operating room, and he said, well, listen, I've had to fit you in. So we'll just put you on the nitrous and I'll be back. Well, he didn't come back for like 15, 20 minutes.
Okay. Wow.
I had a mystical experience. I had divine presence for 15, 20 minutes. Yeah. I mean,
wow.
Okay, so I have, I have the rudder named Karoli Baba of divine presence, and it was just totally there for me, and I was just an extraordinary experience, and just exactly this, in which the center and periphery of things seem to come together. The ego and its objects are one, and then transcendence happens. So I do think, and let me read this one thing. He says, William James, who's fantastic. I got to do a podcast just around William James. Rational consciousness is but one special type of consciousness, whilst all about it, parted from it by the flimsiest of screens. And that's everybody... It is very, very flimsy, these screens that we have. There lie potential forms of consciousness entirely different. We may go through life without suspecting their existence, but apply the requisite stimulus, and at a touch they are there in all their completeness. No account of the universe in its totality can be final, which leaves these other forms of consciousness disregarded. So, I mean, that's very much what we're talking about here with Alistair in terms of it is real. And of course, your summation of it, and you as a young man and going to Papua New Guinea, and never mind that, just walking, as you say, I love this, just walk the streets. You are not, you are bound, and there is no question that you will be confronted by the reality of suffering and what, of course, the Buddha said, and you have an opportunity in that moment. To me, it's two things. Obviously, to do something like help somebody up, an older person up the stairs with a bag, but at the same time, watch your reactions, watch your motivations, watch the way in which, I don't want to go there because it's going to intrude. I got to go somewhere right now. Watch all the ways in which we cut ourselves off from people. And in that watching, which can't come from a judgmental thing, and that's why it comes from being more immersed in the spiritual heart, coming from your perspective of that rather than your head and your ego.
There we go.
Yeah. So
good. You see, it's like, you know, opportunity favors the prepared. So on Monday night, I was coming home in the centre of Glasgow, got off a train, went to a bus stop, and just as I was approaching the bus stop for Agu, I saw a man, a drunk man, violently throw a cigarette end at a visibly Muslim woman. She was waving the veil and so on. What do you do? Well, just it was just like it was choreographed. Immediately, four of us from out of the queue surrounded the man who had done this. And basically, gradually, to cut the story short, defused the situation. But what was so interesting is that there were four of us who did this. But at one point in it, the husband of the woman who'd been assaulted in this way got quite agitated, and the drunk man was closing in on him to pick a fight. And I said to the husband, you know, you need to be careful, otherwise, you know, you might be turned into the victim here. But the thing was escalating. And it suddenly came to me, you know, the Islamic word for peace is salam. And I just said to him, salam. He froze. I followed it up and said, assalamu alaikum, the Muslim greeting. And he just broke into a smile and stood back, and it defused. Now, these are the kind of ways that if we ground ourselves in one another's spiritual traditions, in situations of conflict or potential conflict like that, we can be ready, I would say, as moved by the spirit, as moved by the deep spirit of life, the Holy Spirit, whatever you want to call it, we can be ready to step into these situations. And if we show respect but don't show fear, then we're kind of to do that. It doesn't always work. I have come away blooded from such interventions on one occasion. It doesn't always work, and some people die in these situations. But on the whole, I think it allows us to walk through the valley of the shadow of death, but to fear no ill.
Really. And I love the idea. It's the little things that help us break through fear.
There we go.
Basically.
There we go. It's the little things of your action and service. You know, it's little things like you bothering to do these podcasts and so on and sharing Ram Dass stuff with us. That must be quite hard work. It must be quite a grind at times and so on. But it's the act of service in doing that magnifies these things out into the world and multiplies blessing.
Oh, this ain't no act of contrition here. Talking to you, let me tell you, this is called delight, Alistair.
Well, likewise. You know, I once met Ram Dass. I was presenting Ralph Metzner, whose mother was from Ayrshire. And so was Timothy Leary's people being Irish and Ram Dass being Jewish. You know, one of my jokes is that the whole counterculture revolution was set off by a Scotsman, an Irishman, and a Jew. But I had occasion through Ralph Metzner, to be invited to speak about the land issues and the spirituality at the 1994 conference of the International Transpersonal Association in Killarney in Ireland, at which Ram Dass was the big star speaker. And you know, we all met each other as presenters in the presenter pre-session. But what happened later on is that I was walking through the long corridor, and there was Ram Dass coming slowly towards me. And I thought, my goodness, you know, here's my opportunity to sort of shake hands with the great man and so on, whose work was already an inspiration to me then. And, you know, Raghu, as Ram Dass approached, I just felt to myself, you know, here he is at a conference of 1,000 people or so. The last thing that poor man wants is somebody else coming up to take a few minutes of his day. So yeah. I just bowed my hands and bowed my head and passed by. And let me tell you, Raghu, the sense of darshan, the sense of blessing that I experienced as that happened has never left me. And it's that sense that when I listen to these podcasts that you do and benefit yet again from these teachings comes back on me. And by not invading his privacy, he gave me a gift that is always there.
Mm, that's really beautiful.
Please tell him that.
Oh, I will. I will absolutely. And by the way, the one thing we haven't mentioned in all of this, which is the core of everything you're talking about, everything that we represent and is the core of humanity, is unconditional love. And not the love that's a business between us. You do this and I'll love you, you know, between marriages relationships whatever it is.
Yeah.
And I'm just so pleased to meet you where that love has just been sitting with me for this last hour. So, Alistair, it's just a wonderful thing. And I really appreciate you being here with us. And I'm so glad to have met you. And everybody out there, all the books, Alistair's books, ways to get in touch, some of the other things we talked about, and the Ronnie Lang book, I got to get that book. So that'll all be available on the show notes on BeHereNowNetwork.com/mindrolling. And you'll be able to link it all up. And we're happy to have had you. That's all I got to say. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you. It's been such a privilege. And go well. Go well, my friend.
Thank you. We'll see you all next week on Mind Rolling. Ram Ram, as they say in India.